Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to March's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce to you our speaker for today, Professor Simon Platt, based at the College of Veterinary Medicine, University of Georgia. Thank you, Simon. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to check that the audio is working before we get started. Okay, that's great. All right, let's get started now then. Thanks for attending. This session is going to be dedicated to a practical approach on painful spinal diseases, almost developing a cheat sheet of what to consider when you're faced with a dog that presents to you with neck or back pain. We haven't got time, unfortunately, to deal with all of the causes of pain. We will make mention of most of them, but we're going to talk about how essentially we can treat for the treatable throughout the presentation. Okay, so we're going to start with a practical example. We're going to meet Tuffy, who is a 10-month-old female bull terrier. And when we watch this video, or part of it, we can see that Tuffy is presented with fairly moderate neurologic dysfunction. This is going to be important when we talk about some of the causes of neck and back pain. Tuffy essentially was normal about 4 or 5 days ago and then began to exhibit pain to the owners, manifested by this ventriflexion of the neck that the owners saw, and then neurologic dysfunction started to ensue and has progressed. So we've got a progressive condition over several days that is primarily manifested by pain, but then starts to be accompanied by neurologic dysfunction. Just to give you a summary of the rest of the exam, the cranial nerves were normal, the dog's mentation was normal, apart from the what you would expect with severe pain. The dog was not being treated with any medications. There was no evidence of access to toxins. There'd been no trauma. So this is a young dog who'd presented with severe pain that was progressive. And that's what we're going to deal with. And we'll come back to Tuffy at several points throughout this presentation. So when we look at an approach, it is similar to how we'd approach most neurologic conditions. And as we've talked about multiple times before, we have a logical approach, and it's worthwhile going over that we look at the complaint and the history, and in this case we know it's spinal pain, often manifested by ventriflexion if it's the neck, or a rigid spine, or kyphosis of the thoracolumbar spinal column. The history is important as to how acute it was, how progressive it's been, if it's accompanied by neurologic dysfunction, obviously if there's been any trauma, as we have alluded to in this case, signalment's important because there will be things that will be more common in older dogs versus younger dogs. Our patient assessment is important to remember, as with all neurologic conditions, that we need to focus on the patient as a whole first, what else has been going on with this patient historically that the owners may now be ignoring because the pain itself is taking priority, and what else is going on physically with the patient. We may need to stabilize this patient, particularly if it's been involved in a trauma, but control its pain, understanding obviously that controlling its pain may inhibit our interpretation of the neurological exam and make it difficult for us to know if the patient is progressing. Neurological exam, well, besides assessing where the pain is it neck or is it thoracolumbar or lumbar sacral, it's important for us to know what deficits exist. Many times these may even determine the prognosis for the case. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Localizing the lesion, sometimes it's only possible to go neck or thoracolumbar spinal column or lumbar sacral area. If the dog's in so much pain, it may be difficult to perform reflexes for us to identify more than those broad categories. Assess the severity, and that implies prognosis. Again, we'll talk a bit more about that. Comes down to the neurological exam. What differentials? That's our cheat sheet for pain that we'll talk about throughout this presentation. Provide analgesia. Well, this is something that is obviously going to be imperative, but again, will cloud our neurological exam if we're going to repeatedly evaluate this patient for progression. So we need to consider what may help without doing that, such as the use of non-steroidals or the use even of anti-inflammatory corticosteroids. We'll address a little bit of that in this presentation. Diagnostic investigation. Consider what you have as a differential and then turn that into a logical approach to testing, obviously based on the owner's finances. So we'll go through, again, bits of that in this presentation. Treatment plan. If we don't know exactly what it is, we can have a treat for the treatable approach. That isn't unreasonable. There will be some things that we can't do if the owner doesn't have a lot of money, particularly if they involve surgery. And then ultimately supportive care. A recumbent patient that is in pain is going to need extra care because often the treatment for pain may sedate the patient, which means that we're now going to have to ensure that he doesn't develop things that he would not come in with, such as aspiration pneumonia, urinary tract infections, urine scald, and the likes. So what is our differential diagnosis of spinal disease, regardless of pain? We'll come on to pain in a second. When we're looking at acute or chronic onset of pain, of spinal disease, sorry, we may have vascular conditions, so fibrocartilaginous emboli, ischemic myelopathy is a big one. We can't forget the more peripheral vascular causes of paresis, such as saddle thrombus or aortic thromboembolism. Inflammatory diseases, whether they affect the bone end plate, so osteomyelitis, distal spondylitis, or the nervous tissue itself, so meningitis, meningomyelitis. We'll address that a little bit in this talk. Trauma, so fracture luxation, that's been addressed in separate talks, but obviously important for us to consider. Anomalous disease affecting the spinal column can include vertebral anomalies such as spina bifida, block vertebra, hemivertebra, butterfly vertebra, and then anomalous conditions affecting the spinal cord, and often not painful, but include spinal diverticula, sometimes called subarachnoid cysts, and syringomyelia. We shouldn't forget that sometimes an anomaly of the skull, so Chiari-like malformation, may affect the spinal cord by resulting being associated with syringomyelia, and also a significant anomaly of the spinal column resulting in atlantoaxial subluxation should be a differential for neck pain. There are rarely toxic, metabolic, or idiopathic causes of spinal disease. So we move on to the neoplastic. Important when we say neoplasia that we should consider three broad areas. That's neoplasia affecting the extradural tissues, primarily the vertebral bodies. Neoplasia affecting the intradural tissues. And so that's often meningioma, nerve sheath tumors. And neoplasia affecting the spinal cord itself. So they may be metastasis or primary CNS neoplasias. Degenerative disease, this can be disc disease, as we'll talk about very shortly, or degenerative myelopathy. And they have fairly different presentations, as we'll get into with this disease, but degenerative myelopathy, not a painful condition. So if we try to narrow that list down, then it is wise for us to see whether we have a painful or non-painful condition associated with our spinal disease. Painful conditions, most of the time we're going to think about disc disease, particularly type 1, so an acute disc disease, and we'll get into this shortly. Discal spondylitis, tumors outside the spinal cord, meningitis, so inflammation of the meninges, and trauma. Probably should put AA subluxation on there as well, so an anomaly that causes pain. Non-painful, as we'd said, degenerative myelopathy is not painful. Often tumors inside the spinal cord are initially non-painful until they cause some swelling, stretching of the meninges, and affect the nerve roots. Then they can be painful. Type 2 disc disease, in the main, is a non-painful condition, but will present to us with acute exacerbations of pain. So if we have a dog which suddenly exercises or falls, we may have a painful situation resulting from the type 2 disc irritating the meninges or the nerve roots, and that compression has been there chronically. So most of the time it's an acute or chronic scenario. But type 2 disc disease itself is not an overtly painful condition, except when it affects lumbar sacral nerve roots and is severe. Ischemic myelopathy, fibrocartilaginous emboli, often non-painful. Initially, they may manifest as a dog which screams out in pain. The owners can describe this in many cases. However, it's rarely a condition which is painful when we evaluate them. This can be also confused with type 3 disc disease, a bit of a misnomer, but type 3 disc disease is the non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion that presents very acutely, per acute, some may say, in often large breed dogs, secondary to activity or trauma, and is a non-compressive disease, so ultimately non-painful, but initially may be painful. So a bit of confusion here that these are classically non-painful conditions, these disc protrusions, type 2, and then there's a type 3, as we just mentioned, and ischemic myelopathy, but they can manifest at some points with some pain. Spinal cysts, multiple areas where a cyst can originate from and exist. They may be within the spinal cord, often that's called syringomyelia. They're classically non-painful, but may manifest with weird clinical characteristics suggestive of discomfort, such as scratching, for instance, as we know in the Cavalier King Charles. So some cysts that occur within the intradural space, subarachnoid space, are often called diverticular, just because they're not enclosed by a membrane. Again, rarely diseases which manifest as pain. So this gives us a bit of a cheat sheet for the patient that presents to us in pain. So if we look at Tuffy, we're now considering a dog that could have disc disease. So what are the characteristics of this, and how is that something that could be possible in this dog? Discospondylitis, a tumor, meningitis, trauma, and AA subluxation. So these are the things that we may consider in Tuffy. How could we narrow that list down further? Well, that comes down to understanding what these diseases actually are and how they will affect an individual dog. So let's talk about the most common of these. And obviously that's intervertebral disc disease, and we've dealt with this in other sessions. So this is just a synopsis really of what to expect, and is this something that could be occurring in Tuffy? So we know that the discs occur from every space from C2 caudally, and they're composed of two areas, two anatomical subunits, nucleus pulposus, annulus fibrosus. They're the two areas. The nucleus is the central area, it's gelatinous, some protein involved in its high water content, 80% water, and ultimately that's the shock absorber of the disc itself. And then the annulus fibrosus is the structural component. This is mainly collagen type 1. It's the outer section that binds the end plates together and contains the nucleus centrally. And so illustration showing our nucleus in the center, annulus fibrosus on the outside, which, as we'll say, is somewhat like the jam in a donut here. So this is our nucleus, and this is the annulus, and I'll come back to this a little bit later when we try to talk about analogy of the liquid portion or softer portion of the disc when we talk about treatment. So again, pathological representation of the disc. The central component here is the nucleus pulposus. See, it's slightly more dorsally situated because here is the spinal column with the spinal cord removed, and this canal here is where that cord would be. And so they have a very small area for the disc to rupture if it wanted to rupture. So the path of least resistance may be upwards rather than down. However, we're rarely actually going to see a dog present if it moves down, so we wouldn't know that anyway. So this is our disc disease, and you can see this concentric distribution of fibers here. It's the annulus fibrosus. So that is our pathological representation here. So when we try to classify the disc disease, as we mentioned, there are two main categories, and there's a third one, a bit of a misnomer, but we'll get into in a second. But there's two main categories. There's type 1 disc disease, which is classically in our chondrodystrophic breeds, and that's an acute nucleus pulposus extrusion. And then we have type 2 disc disease, which is classically in our larger breed dogs, and this is a compression of the spinal cord, and this is resulting from hypertrophy of the annulus fibrosus. The type 3 misnomer, the reason it's a misnomer is that it's actually not related to disc degeneration, and these two types described here are related to disc degeneration. So it's not really a type of disc degeneration. So this is a nucleus pulposus extrusion, and has been described as a non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, a hydrated disc extrusion. It will result in damage to the cord, so hyperintensity that can be seen on the MRI. And it is something which can cause significant neurologic dysfunction. And then pain in the early stages, that can just be for 24 to 48 hours or so. So should be considered, but it is something that is non-surgical. Talking a little bit more specifically about the types of disc disease, we have type 1, which is in the chondrodysplastic or dystrophic breeds. The Dachshund is obviously the poster child for this. And this is due to disc degeneration starting at a very young age. They're predisposed for this disc degeneration, and so much so that most of their discs have exhibited some form of degeneration by 2 years of age, and that can be picked up on an MRI, but it does not mean that there will be any neurologic signs or that this disc disease will lead to neurologic signs or even any type of clinical presentation. So it's the resultant disruption of the disc subsequent to degeneration that will cause our clinical scenario. Type 2 disc disease, as I said, is most common in large breed dogs, and German Shepherds are our poster child, and these are older dogs in the main. It can occur in chondrodystrophic breeds, just as type 1 disc disease can occur in our large breed dogs. So there's some crossover here, but classically this is what pathologically is seen. So it's a much slower onset of degeneration. We could describe this as being the type of disc most commonly seen in people, an age-related type of degeneration where the nucleus pulposus will dehydrate at the same speed as the annulus fibrosus, and the annulus tries to compensate for subsequent movements of the nucleus pulposus by hypertrophying, and it's the hypertrophying that causes protrusion into the canal. You can see, as we mentioned, an acute on chronic scenario. There is some degree of pain receptor accommodation going on a chronic basis, so you will not see a classic pain response in these patients, but there is an acute on chronic scenario that can be seen, and again, very similar to as is seen in people, where a movement or an activity can cause the disc itself, the protrusion, to irritate the meninges and the nerve roots. And it is something then that will present as an acute pain. So something should be considered, but in the main, type 2 disc disease is not an overtly painful condition. And then this nuclear extrusion as well, as we said, has been called type 3, sometimes was called high velocity, low volume discs, now is nucleus pulposus extrusion or non-compressive. And as you can see from this MRI, it gives you the hint that there is some parenchymal change because it's hyperintensity, and within the parenchyma, and you can see a change in the intensity of the extradural material, primarily the fat that's here, which is mixed with nucleus material in this scenario. Non-compressive, so the cord is not really malformed or compressed subsequent to this, because it's a well-hydrated disc in most cases that will herniate into the canal, and no disc degeneration accompanies this, as we see in type 1 and type 2 disc disease. Any breed, but it seems to be most common in large breed dogs, and it's possibly traumatic, but not necessarily an obvious trauma. It could even be just a jump off the couch type of trauma. So the grading scheme, again, as many people are comfortable with, there are a few versions of grading systems for spinal disease and dysfunction. This is the one we're going to use when we talk about how we should determine how to treat these patients. So grade one in this system is pain alone. Grade two is ambulatory paraparesis, so some neurologic dysfunction, but can be accompanied by pain, able to walk. Grade three, non-able to walk but some movement. This is probably where we could put Tuffy, non-ambulatory but still some motor function. Grade four, paraplegic, so no motor function at all. And grade five, paraplegic absent deep pain perception, often called absent nociception. And in this scenario, we're talking about complete loss of pain perception in all digits and around the tail and anal area. So just to make sure everyone's on the same page, when we talk about grade two, the ambulatory paraparesis, this is an example of that. And we can see that this dog does have mild neurologic dysfunction, is able to walk around, does have some kyphosis. You can see that on the turn especially, that there is a little bit of ataxia and there's weakness there. So we class this dog as grade two, so mild neurologic dysfunction, as opposed to a dog who would be unable to stand but still has motor function, which is a grade three. These grading systems aren't particularly accurate in terms of identifying cases which are more severe than this dog, but actually not as severe as a dog who cannot walk, such as this. So we could call this a grade 2.5, maybe. There's a dog who's still able to ambulate, but is much more severe than the one you've seen. And the question that we have to answer, and is yet really to be determined, is how much this affects the prognosis. This dog is much more severe than the case we've just seen, but is not as severe as a dog who cannot ambulate but has remaining motor function. Still, we'll class this as a grade two predominantly because he is able to walk. So important for us to be able to get some assessment of where our neurologic dysfunction exists, because it will help us predict prognosis, as we'll move on to shortly. And this dog is the dog that we're most interested in, because the prognosis is the poorest, and that is the dog who has no motor function evident whatsoever. So this is either a grade four or grade five, and the separation of those two grades will be determined by the presence of nociception or pain perception that we can see. So here, no motor function at all, some pain in the spine. So we know that the dog has a painful condition, but what's now more important is how severe is the accompanying neurologic dysfunction. Pain itself, as we'll go through in this session, is not really a prognostic factor that can help us out, but it is something which, when accompanied by severe neurologic dysfunction, will help us with what disease to consider. So when we see this case, what's most important is the factor that this dog cannot detect any noxious stimulation to his limbs. So as we lie the dog, lateral recumbency here, we are able to see that there's no pain perception. Now the dog is in shift Sherrington, you see, with extensor rigidity of the thoracic limbs. That just means it's an acute lesion. And when we look at the flaccid paraplegia that we see in these pelvic limbs, you'll see it's accompanied by a lack of awareness of noxious stimulation. And so when we're actually going to pinch these digits, it's important to pinch lateral, medial, and then look at tail base. We can start with fingers, but it's important that if you cannot elicit a behavioral response here, then we need to use tools of torture, which are these hemostats here. And we've got no behavioral response here, despite a reflex. That's what's important. No behavioral response to noxious stimulation. That then classes this dog as a grade 5, and the prognosis now is poor. So we could go with presumptive diagnosis in some cases. So could this be Tuffy? Classically, we're faced with a young to middle-aged chondrodystrophic dog, so Dachshund, for instance, that comes in with pain and maybe has weakness associated with it. We can go to our cheat sheet for pain and say, well, number one would be disc disease because of the breed. Trauma, we have to look at whether there's any history there. Infection, inflammation, so discospondylitis, meningitis, meningomyelitis, whether it's infectious or immune mediated, anomalous such as AA subluxation and tumor. And so with Tuffy, well, you're not really a chondrodystrophic breed, and you are quite young. And as we talked about, the disease, the degeneration, will start at a young age. And by, as we said, by 2 years of age, most discs will be dehydrated. But rarely do we see clinical signs in those chondrodystrophic dogs before 2 years of age. So Tuffy at 10 months is very young to be affected. So it would be unlikely. There was no history of trauma in Tuffy. So we move on to whether you potentially have some sort of inflammatory process, an anomalous process, or could you have a tumor? And obviously intuitively, and we'll mention this shortly, Tuffy again would be a little bit too young for that to be a number one differential. What treatment could we do presumptively if we're faced though with a dog who most likely has disc disease? Well, we have those two options, conservative or surgical. And we know that we need a little bit more information before we dive into surgery, but there's some facts that we need to consider to suggest what is, if we have all the information confirming the diagnosis, what is the best therapy? Even if we know there's disc disease there because we spent a lot of money with tests, is it appropriate to go to surgery versus a conservative approach, a medical therapy in these patients? So let's look at how the two treatments might affect ultimately the prognosis for an individual case. The treatment considerations that you have that are factors in determining whether you should go medically or surgically are, as we'll mention in the next slide, neurological status. So, and that's going to come down to whether you have pain perception or not, primarily. Delay in presentation, concurrent medical treatment, previous episodes, lesion localization, these things are soft findings which may help you make a treatment as to sway towards more medical versus surgical therapy. But in addition to neurological status, you're really looking at the economics of the situation. Obviously, if an owner doesn't have the funds, then we're going to go medical. Again, though, important to make sure that the prognosis is adequately discussed, and that is therefore going to come down to the neurologic status of that patient. What is the conservative approach that you can make if that's the best or only way to go? Primarily, if we're talking about type 1 disc disease, you have to consider cage arrest. It's a 4 to 6 week process where you're really looking for the annulus to heal. And when we take you back to that analogy of the donut, there's going to be a hole in that donut that's going to be there with that jam potentially oozing out further. So when an owner asks why there is a difference between the way they would be managed with disc disease versus their dog, most of the time if we're considering type 1 disc disease, that's because there is potential for further herniation through the annulus. So cage arrest is the most important aspect, and it has to be emphasized that it's strict and it has to be long term, so 4 to 6 weeks, and then a gradual introduction back to normal activity. In addition to that, we're often dealing with pain, so we need to potentially consider a cocktail for pain relief, and it is acceptable to use more than one drug depending on what you're used to using and what success you've had with this and how severely affected the patient is. So combinations of opioids such as tramadol, if that's something you have success with. Obviously, there's some contention as to how effective it is in dogs, but that's something that might be used. Gabapentin as a miscellaneous analgesic, again, can be useful in some dogs with more mild to moderate pain. Amantadine is a NMDA receptor antagonist. That's something that is often more useful in chronic pain, those that have experienced wind-up pain. And diazepam, obviously not an obvious choice as an analgesic, but in many cases that have spinal pain, particularly secondary to disc disease, muscle spasm is going to be responsible for discomfort. And so a muscle relaxant like diazepam or methocarbamol would be a useful choice in addition to your more obvious pain relievers. In addition to those drugs, we need to consider inflammation relief, and particularly with type 1 disc disease. So the use of steroids versus non-steroidals has to be considered. And when we use steroids, we're going to use these at an anti-inflammatory dose, so 0.5 to 1 mg per kg per day. Not going to consider the use of high doses of steroids, so methylprednisolone, for instance, or high-dose dexamethasone. Not going to be suitable for these cases. They used to be discussed as a way to improve neurologic function, and now at this time there is no evidence for that property. So we're going to use steroids purely as an anti-inflammatory, and that in itself can relieve pain, versus non-steroidals, whichever you prefer based on your experience. There's no evidence that one is better than another. Okay, so then moving back to the grading system that we had, what is it that is going to be important here in terms of prognosis? When we talk about grade 1 pain dogs, then most of those dogs will make a full recovery when managed conservatively, as will grade 2, so those dogs that present ambulatory and just have some neurologic dysfunction. Again, with a conservative management, they can do extremely well. So it seems odd in those cases that we would recommend surgery, and so we must be missing something, and that's what we'll address shortly. Grade 3, those that are slightly more severely affected with conservative management don't uniformly have a successful outcome. So those dogs may do better with surgery, as we'll see in the next slide, but still can do pretty well with just a medical approach and cage rest. Easier to sell surgery, though, on the grade 4 and grade 5 dogs. And so if you're looking at prognosis for the factor that determines where you're going to go, conservative versus surgical, then surgical is going to win out in these cases. Paraplegic dogs have a 50-50 if you just go medical for a full return to function. And if you're grade 5, then medical management is rarely successful in recovering function. It's not that it will never work, but ideally surgery is of value in these cases. And so comparing that chart with the surgical management prognosis, you can see that it's pretty similar for grade 1 and grade 2 cases. For grade 3, where we had 70% success with medical management, we've now got 90% success with surgery. Grade 4, as you said, easier to convince that surgery is warranted in these cases because you have up to 90% success with grade 4 cases compared to 50-50 with the medical management. And then grade 5 is kind of time dependent. This is a contentious area, but the sooner that surgery is performed, the better. Most people will suggest that within 24 hours is adequate. But recent work suggests that maybe even 48 hours. The sooner the better is probably the philosophy to adopt. When we look at that timing, then we do know that after 48 hours, the chances are pretty slim. After 7 days, we discuss the chances being as close to zero as they can be, and that within the first short time period, whether that's 24 or 48 hours, then that is a 50-50, maybe slightly higher, up to 60% in some studies, suggesting that that full function can be regained. So what is that successful recovery? Well, you've got to be ambulatory without assistance. That does not mean you're normal. It's important to emphasize that some ataxia, some proprioceptive dysfunction can be evident. Non-painful, that's going to be the main marker for success. And so sometimes we're going to come up with surgical advice for patients who have improved neurologically with conservative approaches but have maintained a painful scenario. And then urinary and fecal continence. So obviously ambulation and removal of pain is important, but urinary and fecal continence should not be ignored as a possible bystander effect in these cases. So that's a successful recovery. So when we talk about 70%, 90%, they must fulfill these criteria to fit into those percentages. And so we were missing something, and missing something in those cases that present with pain only, for instance. Why should you consider surgery in the cases that present with pain only when the success rate or outcome is almost identical to surgery? Well, it comes down to recurrence. And so if we were to face four dogs that present with back pain, then we're going to see a slightly different response in each of these dogs, which may help you with making a decision as to which way you need to go in the future. The first dog here may be treated, all of these dogs can be treated medically, and the first dog can actually do very well and never come back again. And so there's certainly a justification for medical treatment of back pain. As we saw, many dogs can do well, but the problem and the thing we're missing is that there is recurrence. And so dog two and three in these cases can actually do well, but then will recur within 1 to 2 years. And so 50% recurrence is what we're missing. It's okay to tell an owner that a dog with back pain due to disc disease can do well with rest and a conservative approach, but it's important to emphasize that recurrence is a factor in 50% of these dogs. And at the time of recurrence, at the latest, we should consider surgery. And then in the fourth candidate, then that one often will progress rapidly to neurologic dysfunction and does require surgery. So you have 25% that do well, further 50% that do well but will recur, approximately 25% that will need surgery. So this is what we have to bear in mind when we're advising whether a conservative approach versus a medical approach is ideal for an individual case. So what needs surgery in those cases of type 1 disc disease? Obviously those that are paralyzed, the grade 4 and grade 5 cases, those cases that have recurrence, so the 50% cases, those that have refractory pain, and those that are deteriorating, which was dog 4 in that analogy there. So that's our disc disease, but there are multiple other causes of spinal pain that we need to consider, because at this stage it seems that in the dog in our initial video is unlikely to have disc disease based on her age. So the next set of conditions we need to consider are inflammatory in basis, and these are broadly infectious diseases or immune mediated if they're affecting the nervous system, and infectious if they're affecting the vertebra. And again, these have been covered in other sessions. This is just a brief overview. When we talk about infectious conditions, then some of these are vaccinated for, but still there may be breakthroughs depending on where you live and how prevalent these conditions are. So viral diseases like distemper and rabies should be considered. Bacterial diseases, not as prevalent in animal nervous system as in humans, but it's still a possibility, particularly if you're immunosuppressed or you've suffered a trauma such as a bite. Protozoal diseases, toxoneospora, rickettsial diseases, again, these are geographical concerns, less so in the UK, parts of South Europe, you need to be concerned about this, and definitely in the USA. And fungal diseases, again, geographically concerns. So some of these aren't major players, but overall in well-vaccinated regions of the world, infectious diseases only are prevalent in about 2 out of 10 dogs presenting with inflammatory disease of the nervous system, and the rest are immune-mediated, pathogen-free, or the meningitis of unknown etiology cases. So most of the dogs are immune-mediated, whereas most cats are going to be actually infectious when we consider FIP, toxo, and depending on where you live, the potential for cryptococcus. Rarely we'll see parasites, again, depends on where you live as to how prevalent this is and what type of parasite you would consider. Inflammation affecting the bone Then discus spondylitis is a concern in most regions of the world. 80% of these cases are bacterial and they're due to staph. Other considerations are aspergillus, particularly in German Shepherds, which have an immune system issue with IgA, mucous membrane barriers. Osseous inflammation is often seen on a radiograph to confirm your suspicions, but it can take a couple of weeks. So in the first few days, you may see normal radiographs. However, radiographs taken as a diagnostic test in these dogs with neck pain is obviously going to be important to help you determine whether there's the presence of trauma, neoplasia, or more chronic conditions like collapsed disc spaces due to disc disease or discus spondylitis. If we do see discus spondylitis, then the diagnosis is based on the presence of lysis as well as sclerosis. Sclerosis can occur with any instability, so secondary to chronic disc disease, for instance, and that can form as a bridging unit across the ventral aspect of the vertebra. Can sometimes look as though there's a fracture present, but actually it's just bridging and non-unified. It's the lysis, though, at the end plates that's the most important sign to actually investigate discus spondylitis. This is a condition that is successfully treated most of the time with a medical approach based on the fact that 80% are staphylococcus. We can treat these with bone penetrating antibiotics that will target that bacteria, so amoxicillin, trimethamine sulfonamide, for instance, cefalexin. Unfortunately, they need at least 8 weeks treatment, and if we were going to treat effectively, we should probably treat until a couple of weeks after radiographic resolution. Pain relief is necessary in these cases, and this is a time that non-steroidals are going to be essential versus steroids if we were going to make an anti-inflammatory pain reliever choice. So prognosis is good, but in some cases surgical disease is a possibility, and that's where we would probably need more advanced imaging in those cases that are non-responsive to antibiotics. In this case, MRI can help us, and this is a lumbar sacral junction of a dog with discus spondylitis. Could actually just appear as a degenerative condition because what we've got is compression of the nervous tissue here in the region of the annulus underneath the conus. And we can see with these large arrows that we've got bone proliferation. Not too clear as to what the process is here, but when we administer contrast, as you'll see in the next slide, we'll be able to see that there is bone takeover of that contrast confirming an inflammatory process. Here in the transverse section of that same dog, we can see nerve roots in the canal seem to be reasonably healthy, but there is a lateralized compression and there is bone proliferation around the nerve exit at the foramen, so that can cause tremendous pain in itself. Then when we administer contrast, as we've talked about here, you can see epaxial musculature, sublumbar musculature take up with that contrast, bone take up with the contrast, and then there is some contrast take up in the canal here as well, in the annulus. So confirmatory of an inflammatory condition. Neoplasia is very rarely going to jump disc space, so that is something that will help you out. And in the early days, MRI, although expensive, can help confirm discus spondylitis in those cases where radiographs are normal. Again, when we do contrast in the case in the transverse view, we can see tremendous take-up in the bone itself and in the tissues around the bone and around the spinal cord. So again, confirmatory of an inflammatory process. We talk about infectious diseases, as we mentioned, affecting the nervous tissue. They can be of a variety of causes. Depending on where you live, you have to consider what's most likely. These can be focal or multifocal and can just present as neck or back pain. Seems to be more common in the neck than the back. And they're not always pyrexic or septic. These may just be infections that are locked in the nervous system and the packaging of the nervous system, causing pain due to meningitis or neurologic dysfunction due to myelitis or even creeping into the brain. So it may be a multifocal condition. So it's important in those dogs that have neck pain to evaluate them for neurologic abnormalities. That includes not just spinal cord associated abnormalities, but those that may be referable to the brain. So you can treat with sulfonamide drugs and clindamycin if you believe that there was a protozoal disease. A combination of these things can help. Bacterial diseases can be treated with doxycycline, as can some tick-associated diseases, versus metronidazole for those anaerobic infections, maybe secondary to a bite injury, for instance. When we talk about the unknown etiology cases, these include GME and necrotizing diseases that often affect our small, young, pure breed dogs. Those neurological signs are often accompanied the neck pain that goes with it, and they are progressive conditions. Multifocal, as we said, can involve the brain, maybe presenting with some visual dysfunctions, some vestibular abnormalities, maybe seizure and change of behavior. Primary treatment revolves around immunomodulation. This can involve the use of immunosuppressive steroids, but then there are multiple secondary drugs sometimes used as a first-line defense by some practices. They include cytosine, cyclosporine, azathioprine, and recently mycophenolate. So these are drugs which are immunomodulators. They work in different they work with different underlying manners, and so the use of two drugs combined, it can often be synergistic. So as an overview, again, we've dealt with this when we've dealt with primarily with meningitis of unknown etiologies. How you deal with this medically if we didn't know what was going on. For instance, if we had to look at Tuffy as a case example, where if we had time on our hands where the neurologic dysfunction wasn't too severe, we would treat for infectious diseases with antibiotics and anti-inflammatory steroids, and that would be a reasonable approach in Tuffy if we thought this was a possible cause. And if we saw a response, then we would just continue with our antibiotics, and the anti-inflammatory steroids would be discontinued after about 3 or 4 days. If we didn't get a response, then depending again on the time that we had and what dysfunction was present, then we might actually have to change antibiotics or consider that it was more likely that the dog had an inflammation that was immune mediated. And so that's when we would switch over to the other side. The problem here is if we make a mistake, the 2 out of 10 dogs that have an infectious disease will ultimately deteriorate. So we need to monitor them closely. We could choose immunosuppressive steroids, and if we see a successful outcome in the first few days using anywhere from 2 to 4 milligrams per kilogram per day, then we would step down that dosage over time, at least 2 weeks of 2 milligrams per kilogram per day are going to be necessary in these cases. If you don't see any response during that period of time, then immediately you need to look at using one of the secondary immunomodulators, and that may include the drugs that we mentioned, cyclosporine, mycophenolate, cytosine. Important though to consider, if we haven't got an accurate diagnosis, that it may be a fatal disease, that still may be an inflammatory disease, just not treatable, or it may even be a neoplastic condition. And so at all times we need to be communicating with the owner that this is a scenario where we are treating for treatable, and we are looking at the response of the dog to change the flow of treatment that we make. So it's important to recognize that we may be up against a fatal disease, or we may be up against a disease that we're unaware of because of the lack of diagnostics. So we dealt with disc disease and inflammatory conditions, those affecting the bones, those affecting the nervous system. So it's important for us to recognize spinal neoplasia as an important cause of pain. As we said, this neoplasia can have 3 broad locations. So extradural, particularly affecting the vertebra. And these can be classic bone tumors that are primary. They don't have to be metastatic. So most commonly osteosarcoma, fibrosarcoma, particularly in cats, and then hemangiosarcoma, also chondrosarcomas, and then our round cell tumors, lymphoma and multiple myeloma, should all be considered. They can just affect one vertebra. They rarely cross the end plates, and they're something which are going to need aggressive investigation and can just manifest initially as pain. Intradural tumours, we mentioned, often are nerve sheath tumours and meningiomas, but again, can't forget lymphoma. And then intramedullary, less common. These are the spinal cord tumours. They can be primary tumours of the spinal cord, so glial cell tumours like astrocytoma, or they may be metastatic. So location of the disease is difficult to actually determine without MRI help, but we need to consider all locations when we're considering a painful condition. Most painful are going to be our vertebral diseases, tumours. Next will be our intradural, and then least painful to sometimes non-painful are going to be the diseases within the spinal cord. So radiographs again are a way forward for us diagnostically. But as we said, we discussed spondylitis, they're going to let us down in the first few days, and that may be the case with neoplasia, but important to recognize even when we can see it that we're probably not seeing the whole disease process, so just the tip of the iceberg. Because it's going to take about 60% at least of the bone to be lysed before you're actually going to see it on a radiograph. So where we can see here the spinous process and maybe the articular process involved in this condition, when we actually investigate that with an MRI, you can see that we have a more extensive condition that is entering into the canal and compressing the cord. So this is where more advanced imaging can help you with assessing the extent of the disease itself and therefore determining what the best treatment may be. Because whereas this would be a painful condition, now this is something where we're going to expect neurologic dysfunction, and we're not, as you can see, going to get successful margins surgically. So these are difficult to assess without advanced imaging. We could look at myelography, where we're looking at the indirect effects of the tumor to determine where it's located and what it might be, but it unfortunately doesn't give us the soft tissue margins of this type of tumor. So we're looking for filling defects and deviations of the spinal cord. So we can see a filling defect here where the subarachnoid column truncates prematurely, and there's no filling in the space between C1 and C2. So the indirect effects of the tumor is what we're looking for on myelography. And unfortunately, that doesn't give us enough information. It does tell us that we should suspect tumor, but doesn't tell us the margins of it if we were going to treat this more aggressively. CT may add something to this because we will get an idea as to whether we've got bone involvement. In this case, we don't, but you can see myelography outlines the cord and shows us that we have something that is in the canal compressing that cord, in this case dorsally. And then the use of MRI goes without saying, that is something that's going to identify the soft tissue margins of the tumor. Not great at identifying bone involvement, unfortunately, so radiographs and CT scans are still useful adjuncts, but the soft tissue involvement of any tumor can be well delineated. So here we have soft tissue tumour in the region of the C2 vertebra compressing the spinal cord dorsally, and we can see that it compresses it laterally as well, is in the canal, but it's difficult to know what bone involvement is present in this, and so therefore difficult to know the origin of the tumour, and therefore difficult to know prognosis. The prognosis with vertebral tumours is particularly poor. There are not many studies which will confirm this. What we do know, though, is with very aggressive treatment that involves surgery, radiation therapy, we're looking at an average of 4 months, and sometimes this aggressive surgery, resection as well, may involve the need for stabilization of the vertebra because of the loss of bone structure present. So an expensive solution to alleviating discomfort and neurologic dysfunction. However, the discomfort may not be completely alleviated with surgical resection because the tumour is within the bone itself. And so in addition to those specific treatments for surgery, we may need some treatments which are going to be primarily analgesic. Treatment for the intraspinal tumours, particularly meningiomas, comes with a better prognosis. In one study that looked at surgery alone for meningiomas, there's a 19-month average survival, Surgery and radiation extended that to the top end of 7 to 8 months, depending a little bit on what type of surgery, what type of radiation was used, but better than vertebral tumours. Still, overall, not a great condition to have. Average age for vertebral tumours and even meningiomas within the spinal column is about 8. So when we look back at Tuffy, we think that it's unlikely that it should be considered a primary differential. So age was pushing disc disease down on the list, and age pushes tumour down on the list, which really ends up, in the absence of trauma, pushing inflammatory to the top of the list. So this is our dog. 2 weeks later, in a situation where the owners had suggested that they could not afford more aggressive diagnostics than radiographs and blood work. And so, based on age, based on the neurologic dysfunction that accompanied this situation, we went with treating the condition with medically, so antibiotics, anti-inflammatory drugs, and analgesics. And so 2 weeks later, we see a dramatic improvement in the dog. As you can see from this video, he's ambulating well, and he has limited discomfort, as you can see by him pulling himself around on the lead. So a successful treatment, what quite is the cause of the neck pain and neurologic dysfunction in this dog, we don't know, but this is a common scenario. So we often have to treat for the treatable. We're faced with a dog who presents in neck and back pain, and we have to, based on signalement history of the occurrence and progression, look at potential causes, see what diagnostics we can perform, and then bit by bit treat for the treatable and change to a new treatment based on success or failure of that treatment. So in this case, antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, and analgesics were used. So that is the end of this presentation as a summary of dogs that present with neck and back pain, coming up almost with a cheat sheet for those cases, and talking about how we should approach them, particularly if owners do not have enough money to investigate them aggressively. A couple of questions to address that have come through, happy to address any later, but one is, are steroids completely contraindicated for the use of infectious diseases affecting the bones, or so discus spondylitis, or nervous system? And the answer is no. They still can have a place, but when used judiciously, so for 3 days, for instance, an anti-inflammatory dose, you may get significant relief of pain and neurologic dysfunction. Most of that neurologic dysfunction is due to inflammation, and they are potent anti-inflammatory medications. Longer than 3 days would be dangerous, just because then of the suppression, potential suppression of the immune system in the light of an infectious process. So 2 or 3 days anti-inflammatory doses is not contraindicated, even in the presence of known bacterial disease. The other question is, should dogs with discus spondylitis be rested strictly while they are being medicated? And in fairness, the answer is yes. There is a potential for secondary disc disease, and there's an instability at the end plate, and so it would be ideal for them to be rested potentially strictly, so on a cage basis, for 4 to 6 weeks at least, while the infection is being treated, and then the end plates end up fusing secondary to resolution of that disease. All right, thank you very much for your attention. As I say, if any questions come through after the session, we'll be happy to answer those, and hopefully that we've addressed somewhat the case that presented to you in pain and how to deal with it if you're financially restricted. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Simon for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.